Boy, for one gunfight, the encounter at the OK Corral in Tombstone, Arizona in October 1881 sure stays on the American memory. That's where Wyatt Earp and his brothers faced off against Ike Clanton and a few more gentlemen. When the smoke cleared, three people were dead, three were injured, and then motion pictures were invented and the scene played out again and again and again. It is taken up anew in the film Tombstone Rashomon, which is the creation of Alex Cox, who lives near Ashland. Tombstone Rashomon is part of this week's Ashland Independent Film Festival. Alex Cox has many film credits over the years. He's the director of more than a dozen films, including Repo Man and Sid and Nancy. He's the writer of both of those films and several others, including Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. He's been an actor in more than two dozen films, long and short, including a stint as porno stud in the film Scarred. Let's get a taste of the work of Alex Cox from a little clip from Repo Man.
I do my best thinking on the bus. That's how come I don't drive, see?
You don't even know how to drive.
I don't want to know how. I don't want to learn, see? The more you drive, the less intelligent you are.
That's Tracy Walter and Emilio Estevez in Repo Man. Alex Cox, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So many things come up, I notice, when you Google Repo Man. I giggled when I saw one that said, could somebody explain Repo Man to me? Is that a compliment?
I don't know. I don't. You'd have to try and figure out what was confusing them.
Yeah.
And then we could be trying to address that problem.
Okay, so an analytical mind, I can tell at work already. So what got you into movies in the first place, Alex?
Oh, I just think I liked them, you know. They are fascinating things. I remember when I was a little kid turning on the television. And in England in those days, the television didn't broadcast in the afternoon, but they must have been trying something out or doing some experiment or just running something to, you know, make it all work. And I saw this Japanese guy getting shot full of arrows and was astonished and thought, what is this? You know, and of course, somehow they were screening Throne of Blood at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on the BBC. And so I was fascinated and continue to be fascinated. Still like to see that guy shot full of arrows all these years later.
Who were your training wheels? Who helped you and who did you want to emulate as you were learning the ropes yourself?
Well, I guess when I was young, the most famous and highly regarded British film director was Lindsay Anderson, and so who had directed If and Oh Lucky Man. Oh Lucky Man in particular was this extraordinary film about England and about ambition and about the nature of society. And there were other great directors. There were other great English directors. There was Nicholas Rogue and David Lean was still alive. You know, there were a number of very, very interesting English film directors. And, of course, then there was America, you know, the giant, you know, with so many great directors. And I think one focused more on directors in those days. You kind of knew there was a director involved and the director had an individual vision, whereas perhaps now it's more the director exists at the service of Marvel Comics.
Oh, I was going to ask, so is the producer system stronger now? I mean, did the producers have a greater stamp, or does the brand of whatever it is that they're putting out there have a greater hold on the imagination than the director does?
I don't think producers have much power either. It's the financier has the power, which tends to be the studios, you know. And the studios are often just a branch of a larger entity, you know, like General Electric or Viacom. And so, I think the producers and the directors and the writers are kind of all pretty far down the totem pole in terms of autonomy.
What sorts of stories do you gravitate to, Alex? What makes the difference between, well, that's cool, and boy, I could make a film about that?
I think I'm interested in the location a lot of the time. The location seems to be what draws me, and then I think, well, what story could be told here? And in the film that I've just finished, the one that's playing on Saturday night at the AIFF, I was really interested to know how long it took the protagonists to walk out of the saloon, down the street, turn left, and get involved in this difficulty. And so I actually went down to Tombstone and walked it out, and it took them 1 minute and 45 seconds. So there was no time really to think or make a plan or have a viable strategy, because it was all just too quick.
We were able to everybody can do this. They can go to your Indiegogo site where you raise some money for the film and get a look at some of the clips. And there's one here called Alex Makes a City Model that we grabbed. I just want people to hear the process you went through as you set up the downtown of Tombstone from Tombstone Rashomon.
Be careful.
Pizza time!
Oh, pizza, my favorite.
No, not that one. No, let's move to the next one, the Alex Makes City.
Yeah, I wonder what that was.
Johnny Bean's getting a shave. He sees Virgil come out of Hafford's saloon to the Wells Fargo office, borrow a shotgun. He thinks I'd better hurry up and finish my shave. Virgil goes back, meets with his brothers at the saloon. Yep, boys have their base more or less at Hafford's saloon, and they can't help noticing right next door at Spangenberg's gun shop. The Clantons and the McLowry's are loading up on ammunition. Johnny leaves Hafford's and walks up the street, turns left, and finds the McLowry's outside the butcher's shop. Then the Arabs hear that the cowboys aren't in the OK Corral anymore, a place where they have the right to carry arms, and they head out to confront them.
And so I should explain, you're actually working with cardboard models of the buildings here. You really wanted to get the whole scene laid out before you even approach the beginning of the shooting, it looks like.
Because I hadn't yet gone down to Tombstone, and though I did inquire, nobody could actually tell me how long a city block was in Tombstone. So the cardboard model was an attempt at figuring that out, but I actually had to go and down there and actually walk it out to see to finally achieve that number.
All right, Tombstone Rashomon is the film. Alex Cox is the director, and it really takes a look at the shootout at the OK Corral from several different perspectives. We'll get more into the meat and bones of the film when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange with your phone calls and emails in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Alex Cox, a longtime veteran of the film industry with many credits as director and writer and actor. His latest work is called Tombstone Rashomon, which is airing at the Ashland Airing is what we do. Screening is what they do. The Ashland Independent Film Festival this week in Ashland, April 6th through 10th. You can join the conversation with Alex Cox on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So as we were talking about at the beginning, I mean, so many movies have taken up the story of what happened at the OK Corral. I mean, even a Star Trek episode, I think, is my first knowledge of what had happened there. What did you feel was lacking, or what else did you want to do that hadn't been done, Alex, in those tellings?
Well, most of the films which have been made about the events adjacent to the OK Corral take a position, you know, that usually the position that the side of Wyatt Earp and his brothers and Doc Holliday is the good side, and the cowboys are these kind of depraved, murderous individuals, you know, who get their just desserts. But if you delve into the historical record, obviously it's not quite as simple as that. And it turns out to be a dispute, perhaps not surprisingly, between Democrats and Republicans. The Earps and Holliday are Republicans, and they work for the moneyed interests of the town, the gambling and saloon-owning faction. The cowboys represent the rural districts, the countryside. The cowboys involved in the gunfight were also Democratic election officers who had delivered a recent sheriff's election to their candidate, Charles Scheibel. There was then a recount. It turned out the cowboys had kind of stuffed the ballot boxes, and the election was narrowly awarded then to a guy called Bob Paul, the Republican candidate, whom a faction in the vicinity, perhaps allied to the cowboys, had tried to assassinate. assassinate in a stagecoach robbery a few weeks previously. So it's all really antsy, you know, and het up stuff that has to do with political rivalries, because there's an awful lot of money to be made from being the sheriff of Pima County or the sheriff of the newly created Cochise County. A lot of money, a lot of power involved, and in a way the IRPs are just simply acting as the enforcers for one faction against another powerful faction in the vicinity. But neither side necessarily has right on its side. And so I think what's interesting from the point of view of our film is that we tell the story from a number of different perspectives, some of whom support the IRPs, some of whom support the Clantons, some of whom might even be telling the truth, and some of whom are obviously telling outrageous lies.
Are they all characters not central to the gunfight itself? In other words, not the IRPs and not Ike Clanton?
Some of the interview subjects are central to the fight. Four of the interviewees were present for the fight. One of the interviewees says that she was in an adjacent building and watched it through the doorway. And the sixth interviewee wasn't there at all. He eschews these fights because he's more interested in ornithology and stuffing birds, which he then sends to the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C.
So you say interviewee. I mean, is this done truly documentary style?
Yes, it is. It's as if a time-traveling video crew had journeyed back to Tombstone in order to film the gunfight, and then realized they got there on the wrong day. They got there a day late, and so instead they set about interviewing the protagonists.
And so is it sequential? Does each person get their whole story told and then the next, or is it a bit more interleaved?
Fragments. I mean, it gets a bit interleaved. We start out with a little bit of Ike Clanton, then we have the saloon keeper, then we have the prostitute, then we have one of the IRPs, then we have the sheriff. But it tends to get broken up a little bit towards the end, and they start intruding upon each other's stories.
Alex Cox is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the creator and director of Tombstone Rashomon, which is part of the Ashland Independent Film Festival this week. You can join the conversation at 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a question from Anne and Eugene. Welcome to the Exchange.
Thank you so much. You know, I've been a fan of independent films for years. I've seen Repo Man and Sid and Nancy and Fear and Loathing, and enjoyed all of them very much. I can remember seeing on television as a teenager in the 50s, Rashomon, and growing up in St. Joseph, Missouri, except for books, I had few other intellectual opportunities. And seeing that on television with all the different perspectives was a real eye-opener. So my question is, we have two independent theaters in Eugene, Bijou and Metro, and I was wondering if Rashomon and Tombstone are going to be shown at either one of those. Thank you.
All right, thanks, Anne. Appreciate that. Any idea about that, Alex?
Well, they would be delighted to be invited. They would be pleased to be shown there. I think I've been to the Bijou. I think I've shown them. That sounds very familiar, so maybe I was there for a screening previously. Yeah, they would love to be screened there.
Let's talk about, because she referenced the original Rashomon, and I've been a little remiss in not getting the backstory on that. Rashomon was a Kurosawa film from 1950, is that right?
It's a Kurosawa film. It won a prize at the Venice Film Festival, which really surprised the financiers because they thought that the film wasn't going to do any business, and certainly not internationally. And then it became this big international hit and established Kurosawa as an important director. Although the Japanese always were a little dismissive of him in the sense that they thought, you know, oh, well, he's primarily a director for foreigners, you know. And they Ozu was the guy that they most revered, but certainly for us foreigners, you know, Kurosawa was like, boy, a majorly influential director.
And so in Rashomon, there's a murder and four different witnesses' stories are told?
Let's think. Yes, four. But one guy gets to tell his story twice. There's a character called the Woodcutter, played by Takashi Shimura, and he gets to tell his story a second time. And the screenwriter of Rashomon Hashimoto wrote a very interesting book quite recently. He's still alive. He's in his 80s or even 90, and he just wrote a book about working with Kurosawa. And he said that he was disappointed in the way that Rashomon turned out, because when Shimura gets to tell his story the second time, you do get the impression, okay, that's what really happened. And Hashimoto said that's not the point. The point of the story, the original story, In a Glade, which Rashomon is based on, is that you just don't know. You don't know who's telling the truth. And so I think we've gone more in that direction with our film. I hope that you're not going to come out of there thinking, oh, well, that guy was right and everybody else was lying, you know, because everybody's got their agenda, you know.
Let's play another clip from Tombstone Rashomon. Here's one called Armed As They May Be.
Look, Johnny, there's an armed gang in the corral down the street. They've threatened my brothers and me. Like Wyatt says, well within my rights to shoot them down on sight.
Well, not technically speaking, Marshal. You see, the difficulty here arises out of City Law Number 9, which prohibits the carrying of deadly weapons inside the city limits of Tombstone. Now, that rule was adopted by the mayor, town council, some 6 months ago. Section 2 of City Law Number 9, well, that exempts ones from its provisions, provided that they are on their way to a corral or a hotel to deposit their guns, or on their way out of town, or already inside a corral. So, as long as Ike and Billy and the McClowrys were inside the OK Corral, armed though they may be, they weren't breaking any law.
Who's speaking there, Alex?
So the first person speaking is Virgil Earp, brother of Wyatt, who is a federal marshal and also a city constable at Tombstone. The second speaker is Johnny Bean. Johnny Bean is the sheriff of Cochise County, so he, strictly speaking, I think has seniority over Virgil. And Johnny is describing this complicated law which had been introduced quite recently in Tombstone, delineating where and where you could not carry a deadly weapon, such as a firearm or a knife. If you were in a corral, leaving or just arriving in town, you could have a gun. But if you went out on the street, you were supposed to turn that gun over to a saloon keeper or to the owner of the corral for safekeeping for the time that you spent in town. And so, ironically, if the cowboys had remained in the OK Corral, there probably wouldn't have been a difficulty because they weren't breaking the law. But when they stepped outside the OK Corral with pistols in their belts or with rifles in the scabbards on their horses, then they were breaking City Law Number 9. And Johnny and Virgil Earp had different approaches as to how to deal with that.
How fascinating was this to dig into this story and the actual legal construct and get beyond just the standard good guy, bad guy, dust and tumbleweeds in the streets kind of way of telling the story?
It's really great because it's so interesting, because you see from very early on how factionalized everything was, and how the cowboy faction is really trying to get the Earps and Holiday hung for what they viewed as cold-blooded murder. And you can see also the cowboy faction, the Earp faction, the gambler faction, how they're kind of constructing their stories and maybe even manipulating witnesses in order to escape the gallows. So it's all very serious stuff, and luckily it's recorded in a transcript of the inquest and of the Judge Spencer hearing, which followed the inquest, in which essentially parties gave evidence to see if the thing should go to a grand jury or not. And Judge Spicer decided that it was not. He essentially decided that it was justifiable homicide. And so so you can hear Wyatt Earp and Virgil Earp and Johnny Bean and Ike Clanton. You can hear their original voices through the transcripts of these legal hearings. And in the case of Doc Holliday and Kate Haroney, their voices are retained in newspaper interviews and in a letter that Kate wrote to her niece. So in every case, you know, the writer gets a taste of the way that person really spoke and the kind of language that they used.
And did you do some of this research yourself? Did you go through the paperwork yourself?
You betcha. I mean, I don't have anybody else to do that stuff. And it wouldn't want, what would be the good of somebody else doing it? You know, if you're writing the script, you have to do it yourself. Mm-hmm. But it was a really fascinating research project. I mean, it's very fraught. And even now, I mean, the ERPs have got their... The ERPs are generally still supported by the majority of writers, but there's a real faction, especially around Tombstone, of writers who are very pro-cowboy and believe that the ERPs and Holiday were killers.
It really is fascinating when you hear Johnny Behan talking about the specific ordinances and laws and stuff. And I guess you spend so much time, particularly when you're familiar with the story growing up, as any American is, that you don't think in terms of the fact that, oh, they weren't supposed to have guns on the street. You could have it there or you could have it out of town, but you couldn't have it walking through the streets.
Yeah, and Johnny is normally, if he appears in the movie at all, he's like a minor villain. You know, he's like a kind of a henchman of the cowboys. But I think it's too, while he was definitely... I think he was part of that Democratic faction, you know, he wasn't part of the Republican faction. But also, I mean, you know, he was doing the best he could in the circumstances, at least as he saw it. And it's interesting, somebody has pointed out, actually Johnny Behan's biographer pointed out that while Johnny Behan spent his entire life in public service, after being sheriff of Tombstone, or of Cochise County, he was the head of the territorial prisoner at Yuma. He was the governor of the prison. Then he was the Chinese exclusion officer for the state of Arizona. And after that, he was the head teamster for the Spanish-American War, in charge of getting all those horses on boats and getting them out to Spain. So Johnny Behan, you know, the allegedly corrupt sheriff, spent his entire life in public service, and Wyatt Earp spent his entire life as like a not very successful prospector and saloon keeper.
Interesting. Wow, we're learning so much about the characters here. The film is called Tombstone Rashomon. It depicts the shootout at the OK Corral in October of 1881 from the looks of several witnesses. Alex Cox is the film's director. It is screening this week at the Ashland Independent Film Festival. And you can join us at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Mark in Reading. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Alex Cox.
Yes, I have a two-part question. One, how many major distributors are there in the United States? And two, is that the most difficult part about getting a film shown, is getting the distribution after you've made the film?
Most difficult part is getting the money to make the film. The easy part is making the film. And the second most difficult part is getting distribution. How many major distributors are there? I don't really know. I guess that each of the studios has its own distribution company, I think. There's also very large kind of independent distributors like Lionsgate. And then there's other forms of distribution which don't distribute in the cinema anymore, but do online original material for online distribution. But really, it's not that many kind of companies, is it? I mean, probably there's maybe less than 20 major distributors.
But that, for those of us who are not in the movie business, that explains why you see so many different names at the beginning of a movie, because you got the production company and the origination company and the distribution company, and they're all get their little logos up there.
Yeah, and quite likely, you know, maybe one of the actors has his or her own company, and so they get a credit for their company as well. And then, yeah, it is interesting. I mean, you see, the number of producers on films is quite incredible. I mean, we only have about 8, but boy, unlike some movies, you can see like 30 producers. See those names rolling by.
You were talking about the cost of making a film, and Alex, you took this one to Indiegogo to raise the original production costs. Was that the first time you'd done that?
No, well, it was the first time I'd done something on Indiegogo. I raised money for a film on Kickstarter, where we did considerably better. But the Kickstarter film was a science fiction film. I think science fiction is a lot more popular than Western stories, and you know, Kickstarter might be a better platform for raising money for films. But we were fortunate, because even though we raised very little money from the Indiegogo campaign, a distributor called Fandor and some, you know, genuine executive producers, the guys who made Snowden and the Iggy Pop documentary Gimme Danger, they came in and matched the money that we'd raised from Indiegogo and other sources. So we had like a, still a very, very small budget, but enough to afford food and horses.
Were those the big expenses?
Yeah. And the location, but the location, Old Tucson is this functioning western town outside of Tucson in Arizona, and they gave us a great deal and were like super supportive. And it turned out that the guy who was our contact person there, Rob Jensen, was also a stunt coordinator, so he took charge of all of that as well.
We'll talk more about the making of Tombstone Rashomon, screening this week at the Ashland Independent Film Festival. Alex Cox lives in the Ashland area and is the director of the film. You can join the conversation on The Exchange by phone or by email. More with Alex Cox and you in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're spending the hour talking to Alex Cox, a longtime veteran of the movie industry. Independent films is his general domain. He is the director of Tombstone Rashomon, which is screening this week at the Ashland Independent Film Festival, but many film credits that go back many years, including Repo Man and Sid and Nancy. Those are his films. He wrote both of them as well. He is the writer of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, among several others, acted in a bunch of films, you name it. He has done it on either end of a movie camera. You can join the conversation with Alex Cox at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So again, your take on Tombstone and the gun battle at the OK Corral is the Rashomon version, like the 1950 Japanese film. Several different witnesses describing documentary style what they thought they saw there. And once you got the film into production, and you mentioned you were shooting in Old Tucson, after you'd done the cardboard mock-up that we heard you talking about early in the show, how different was what you found in Old Tucson from what actually exists in, or did exist in, Tombstone?
It's interesting because all of the locations that I'm aware of in the United States, Old Tucson is the largest functioning city set. There are some, you know, western town locations which are essentially one street and some ramshackle buildings. But if you're looking for a place which has street corners and views up and down the streets in all directions, that's the only place I know that's like that. So we were very fortunate that it exists. I mean, there is Tombstone as a location still exists, but it's a functioning town. I mean, the traffic is driving through it, you know, and it has tarmac on the streets and T-shirt shops, and parking meters, so we couldn't really shoot in Tombstone without changing the nature of the piece quite a lot. So we were just very lucky to have that location available to us.
Talk about some of the people you had working with you, Rudy Wurlitzer and Phil Tippett.
Oh, Rudy didn't do it in the end. Rudy was going to be the screenwriter when we were trying to raise a decent amount of money, but we raised so little money, I don't even think we could have afforded to pay him just to write the first draft. You know, that would have taken the entire budget of the film. So Rudy, in the end, didn't write the script. Phil Tippett, though, the visual effects supremo, was responsible for four different special effects shots, which are dotted through the film. So at one point, you see Tombstone go from its contemporary incarnation to the way it looked in 1886. And there's three other visual effects shots, which his team created to sort of, you know, amp up that the Western aspect of it, make it look a bit more authentic.
So it really ended up being a lower budget film even than you planned, based on what you're able to pull in through Indiegogo. Which...
it's so cheap. It's unbelievably cheap. unbelievably cheap. And I was just lucky that all the people, the cast and crew are all quite young. You know, a lot of the cast and crew are like recent graduates from the University of Colorado, or still students at the University of Arizona, you know, and we were able to trick them into thinking that working on this film was going to be fun for them.
Was it not?
Oh, maybe it was.
Well, they seem very proud of it. I was actually reading the information on the University of Arizona's website about how proud they were about students assisting with the production.
They were incredible because the U of A provided the entire sound department, which was actually run by a U of A professor, Mike Mulcahy. But they also provided the wardrobe department and the art department. And the woman who was the costume designer, Sam K. Tony, who was a graduate student there, she brought her professor as her assistant, you know. And so we had like this, and the production designer, M. Erdman, had just graduated. This was like her thesis project. So we were very lucky at the quality of the people that we got, because the cinematographer, Alana Murphy, was one of my students at the University of Colorado. A number of the actors in the project were people that I'd met in Colorado, although the bulk of the actors are Arizona natives.
Let's play another clip and get a chance to get some reaction from you on this. So let's play the one called the Opium Poppy.
Take some of this, Dr. Barham Solution. 100% cocoa leaf and opium poppy linctus. Guaranteed to relieve unpleasant pressure on the brain. Tastes good.
I told you, keep out of town, not to show your face on the streets.
Riot. We didn't stop at the Oriental. You said it was getting a bad name.
I told you to keep out of town. I told you, now get inside.
Sure hope it ain't habit forming. Me too.
Alex, what's going on there?
Well, the first conversation is between Kate Haroney, who's the hotelier and prostitute and girlfriend of Doc Holliday, who's talking to Ali Earp, the wife of Virgil. And across the street, they live kitty corner across the street from Wyatt and his wife, Maddie. And the scene is taken from a book by Frank Waters called The Earp Brothers of Tombstone, which, despite its title, is really about the wives, or the common law wives of the Earp brothers. Waters was a pretty famous American writer, and he, as a small boy, had met Ali Earp, the widow of Virgil, in Los Angeles, because as an old lady, she made a living going from door to door selling plastic flowers. And so his whole take on the gunfight at the OK Corral and the Wyatt Earp story came from his interaction with this old lady. So he was very pro the Earp women, and they had a few stories to tell about Wyatt Earp, which were not very flattering. And so we follow his trajectory. Although when Wyatt tells his story, of course, it'll be quite different.
I get the sense, Alex, that you have devoured pretty much anything ever written about Tombstone, Arizona in October of 1881, and can probably cite chapter and verse on most of it.
I don't know if I can cite chapter and verse anymore, but I did. I read everything I could. I read everything I could find that seemed appropriate. There's an old book called Tombstone and Iliad of the Southwest, which is very charmingly written and quite romantic, but a good read. There's Stuart N. Lake's Wyatt Earp Frontier Marshal, which is the kind of the invention of Wyatt Earp as the heroic cowboy killer. And then there's many other books that came since then, you know, with different takes, and some of them are very well written. But I did find the most useful ones were a book called The OK Corral Inquest and another book called Wyatt Earp Speaks, because that contains the Doc Holliday interviews and the Kate Haroney letter.
Is the point of what you did with Tombstone Rashomon so much about the gun battle itself, or the climate in which it took place and what led up to it?
I think it's really about the climate, because the gun battle only took 30 seconds. But what led to it is very interesting. What led to it, why it happened, if it could have been avoided, I find that very interesting. And I do sympathize with the perspective of the sheriff, John Behan, but as Kate Haroney says, he wants you to sympathize with his perspective, you know. That's his goal.
So I understand that you're also getting an award at the Ashland Independent Film Festival, the Rogue Award for this year. What is that about?
I don't know, but I'm so excited. Isn't it great?
It is. Do you consider yourself something of an independent film rogue?
No. You know how it is. It's named after a river, isn't it?
Probably, but you know, you never know. So a question about another film you shot in Tucson, though, because Walker with Ed Harris in 1987.
Yeah.
About the American who became president of Nicaragua. How much did the politics of that time, when there was a lot of American involvement in Nicaragua, have to do with the reaction to the movie commercially and critically?
Oh, I think undoubtedly it did. I mean, I think it was very interesting to see after the film. We thought we were going to have a lot of difficulty because the film took a sort of an anti-imperialist political perspective. Imagine that. It suggested that Americans shouldn't invade foreign, or in general, Americans and Western Europeans shouldn't invade foreign countries, take them over and pillage them for their natural resources or turn them into slave states, you know. But that was, of course, a contentious thing to say at the time, and we almost got away with it. We got a very good review from the New York Times and a very good review from Time magazine. And then came the lumbering presence of Roger Ebert. And Roger Ebert just went to town on that film. He hated it so much. He called me impudent for making it, you know. And
was he coming from a political point of view?
Yeah. And then it was interesting because then Ebert's review became the template for all the reviews that followed. Many years later, I was invited to the London American Embassy to give a talk on a film. So, I don't really know why, but I was invited. And so I went into the bowels of the American Embassy, past the Marine Guards and all that stuff, get into the basement to do a little lecture on Dr. Strangelove. And there, in the, you know, in serried rows of the employees of the American Embassy, you know, to listen to my little lecture, and sitting at the back is Roger Ebert.
Really?
I'm thinking, what the hell is he doing in the bowels of the American Embassy in London? So after I gave my little talk and this and that, and he's getting up to leave at the end, I challenged him. I said, what are you doing here? And he goes, oh, just dropping in, just stopping by.
Happened to be in the neighborhood?
Yeah. Now, do you know anybody who, when they're on their holidays, just stops by the embassy to say hello?
Can't say that I do.
I've never known anybody do that unless perhaps they worked there. And so I suspect that perhaps Ebert was chosen to be the bad news guy for Walker because he had a pre-existing relationship. And it wouldn't be very surprising, would it, given how many journalists are indeed involved with the intelligence establishment.
So you're saying Roger Ebert could have been on the payroll, the federal government?
Sure. A spook? Or maybe he did it for free.
Hmm. You've mentioned being on a blacklist since that time. Was the effect in your career that significant?
Well, I think if all the studios decide spontaneously they're not going to hire you anymore and tell your agent that, then you're probably on a blacklist, aren't you?
Well, it sure sounds like you became poison to somebody for some reason.
But you know what's interesting is that somehow the studios get away with it because in the construction industry, you're not allowed to operate a blacklist. It's against the law. In terms of negotiation, you know, you're not allowed to operate as a cartel. The oil companies can't all get together and fix prices. But the studios can. The studios, when they negotiate, they don't negotiate with the individual writers. They negotiate as a cartel with the Writers Guild. And the Writers Guild is not even a union. It's not a labor union. It's a guild created by the studios so that they can negotiate as a cartel, even though that's against the law. So what the studios are is actually a massive racketeering operation. And I keep hoping that whenever the Republicans come in, they'll go to town on them, you know, because the Democrats obviously never will. But somehow it's bipartisan, isn't it, that Hollywood just gets to do what it wants? I guess because it provides a valuable propaganda function.
Well, it's interesting that every couple of years somebody talks about taking antitrust and monopoly proceedings against either Major League Baseball or the NFL, but I never hear it about Hollywood.
I know, isn't that amazing? And yet Hollywood is far more of a cartel because there's no... Because just for the studios to negotiate en masse, en bloc, for them to, you know, for Disney and Universal and Paramount and United Artists all to get, and Warner's all to get together and just have a united front of negotiation, they're not allowed to do that.
Alex, in a way, has it been a blessing, though, to not have to work and live in L.A. all the time?
Oh, to not have to live in L.A.? Yes, it's a great blessing. It is a great blessing. I can't complain because I have had, as a result of not being able to work in L.A., I've had the opportunity to work in, like, Nicaragua and Mexico and Japan and Holland and Liverpool and all these exotic places, you know, and mustn't grumble.
And you and Todd Davies, your wife, who's been on the program several times, have had a chance to work together, too, haven't you?
And she is the person who originally said that stuff that Tracy Walter said in the clip from Repo Man that you played at the beginning.
I do my best thinking on the bus?
Yes, because Todd, when I first knew her in Los Angeles, didn't drive. And she refused to drive. And she was the one who said, the more you drive, the less intelligent you are. and I just thought, wow, you know, she's onto something here, you know.
Well, we certainly enjoyed having her thinking on the show and certainly enjoyed having you visit with us as well. Alex Cox is the director of Tombstone Rashomon, and he's also the winner of this year's Rogue Award at the Ashland Independent Film Festival. Alex, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right, take care.